I don't know who the chair of this session is. To the best of my knowledge, no one was appointed chair. And I'm going to temporarily take that responsibility, while I won't chair the whole session. And we've decided we're going to introduce ourselves, since no one seems to be appointed to do that. But I will need... in order to have any time for questions, I will need the full 45 minutes that's scheduled, and we're starting a bit late. I'm just going to have to go with that, and then we'll have to kind of make it fit in. Either that, or I may have to skip a couple main points, which may need to do. But I'll try not to rush this. I'll just see how it goes. I'm Ted Davis. I teach history of science and science and religion at Messiah College, and when I publish things, it's actually on vertically on the history of science and Christianity, and historically it's in a couple of different periods, both early modern period, namely what people often call the scientific revolution, and modern America, that is from mostly early to mid 20th century. This is not going to be today a presentation of any of my scholarly work. I usually do that at ASA, but this is very different. This is really just kind of a broad, once-over, lightly survey of some of the main ideas about morality, human nature, science, the soul, these kinds of topics. Not intended to argue for any particular thesis, but rather to show some of the main ideas that have caused people to pause about how to relate things in nature to biblical tradition on these points. So it's going to be a broad kind of survey without an argument, rather than a scholarly paper with an argument. So it's very different from what I normally would do. Well, the questions that I want to consider here are these. Why have some Christians rejected claims about evolution from lower animals as irreligious? Because certainly we know many have. Why have other Christians accepted them? And what have been the most important issues? Well, really, in this particular version, the second question is not going to get a great deal of emphasis here, but I will at least compare the ways in which those Christians who have accepted evolution, I'm going to look at some of the differences in how they approach this. And then in the final case, I'm going to draw some conclusions about what I think the central features are here. Now, to do this, I want to survey about 150 to closer to 175 years of conversation about evolution, morality, and human nature. But to start, I'm going to go way back. I'm going to go back to even pre-New Testament times and look at some of these issues. I'm going to examine Greek and Hebrew ideas about these very, very briefly, hoping to illuminate the contemporary situation. So I'm going to start here. I want to start with Plato's Timaeus, which was undoubtedly the most important book Plato ever wrote in terms of its influence on subsequent ideas. Philosophers today don't typically have students read this in their classes. But, you know, they read other things, the Republic or the Phaedo and other works, which are also important. But for 1,000 years, this was the text that the West had from Plato. This was it. They had Timaeus. They had a translation from Cicero in Latin. And this is what they read. This was the text that influenced their thinking, not only about nature, but also about how to understand the Bible. And it's a very powerful text. It's a creation story in which a slave named Timaeus tells a creation story. And the creation story features a creator. Plato uses the word demiurgos, which is the same word used for craftsman in the book of Hebrews, for the divine craftsman. He uses the word demiurgos. And the creator fashions the universe and gives it a soul. He gives the universe a soul. Now, of course, the Greek conception of soul, whether it's Plato's or Aristotle's, is influential on biblical interpretation, but it doesn't translate straight into the biblical notion of nephesh, or soul. It doesn't translate into that at all. it's a very different conception. For Plato, it's essentially rationality or ability to think. But it also can mean, for Aristotle and for Plato, it can also mean animation, a principle of animation. And the Creator makes the stars to be divine and eternal animals. Aristotle also thinks of the heavens as, in some sense, divine and, in some sense, alive. I won't go into that further here. But these are ideas that Plato and Aristotle have somewhat in common. Subtle differences, but they're somewhat in common. Then there's also lesser gods in the story, and they come from other gods by procreation. Reflecting Greek tradition here, you have, the Theogony is one of the classic Greek works of literature. It's a story about the origin of the gods, and Plato has his own Theogony here in Timaeus. And the Creator himself makes the souls of humans, but lesser gods make their bodies in Timaeus. This is really a fascinating text, and it's a great exercise for students to compare it with Genesis. And see some of these differences as well as some similarities. Now, here's a very different Greek text, Lucretius on Creation, which is known by its Latin translation De Rerum Natura. It's a Roman writer who's influenced by the Greek writer Epicurus. And the gods, if they exist in this text, are irrelevant to the universe and to humans. This is an alternative perspective that Plato really was arguing against in his Timaeus. Plato was arguing against the kind of atomism that Lucretius reflects, these two different currents in classical Greek thought about the universe, whether the universe had a purposeful design or whether it did not. And for Lucretius, it did not. He argued that no thing is ever produced from nothing by divine power, and matter and motion then are eternal. And he argued that atoms move through an infinite void, colliding by chance with other atoms to form objects, including living things. This is a very, very primitive notion of a kind of blind, unguided natural selection and evolution. It's really kind of, that's not obviously not full-blown, but elements that relate to some later ideas are actually found this early, though in very primitive form. As a third text, let's consider this one. And here in this one, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. God, the same God, makes plants and animals. And the same God creates humans in his own image, both male and female. And he does it himself, does it directly, their bodies as well as their spiritual nature. And in this famous text, this is where it's presented to us, that this is the work of God's hands directly rather than the work of lesser gods in any part. And then what happens, of course, is a story that, as was indicated to us yesterday, if you attended the sessions on interpretation of Genesis and theology, the idea known as the fall, which might or might not be the way it was understood by the Hebrew authors and in the early church. But since Augustine, Christians have largely taken the fall to be a very significant moment. And this is the text, one of the texts that applies to that. So what I will consider is that the fall is a key notion here in the text, whether or not it was understood that way early on, because in fact for Christian history, dealing with these issues, the fall was an issue that you have to confront in Christian tradition. So I want to ask this now in the subsequent discussion. What does it mean to be human? And what is the image of God, the Imago Dei? And how has the fall affected this? And these ideas of soul and these ideas of a naturalistic origin are going to come into this conversation from outside of the biblical tradition. The Platonic ideas and the atomistic ideas will come in. But I'm going to focus on the Christian ideas and how those influences are reflected. So to see in a kind of just overview fashion a couple of examples of different ways of understanding the image of God historically, I'm going to look at first the Renaissance writer Giovanni Pico, Italian Renaissance writer. And he has a fascinating text called The Oration on the Dignity of Man, where he gives the following picture. Man is the intermediary between creatures, the king of the lower beings. And here's why. It's by the acuteness of our senses, by the discernment of reason, and by the light of our intelligence. And as he says, on David's testimony, but little lower than the angels. So you kind of were the intermediary, as he says, the intermediary between creatures. A classical hierarchical picture, metaphorically at least, midmost between God and the lowest of creatures. Actually, there's far fewer creatures above us than below us, but in a metaphorical sense, midmost between them. And in this text, Pico has God tell Adam this. You're constrained by no limits in accordance with your own free will, and in your hand we've placed you in your own hand, and you can ordain for yourself the limits of your nature. So we become, in a sense, co-creators with God here in this text. We can create our own destinies, and we are the masters over nature. For a different perspective, let's consider John Calvin's commentary on Genesis, which comes roughly 100 years, very roughly 100 years after the text by Pico. And rather than being in an Italian Renaissance context, of course, this is more of a Reformational context. And what in Calvin's commentary, he comments on the phrase, in our image, etc. This is a direct quotation from the commentary. The biblical text here, and he adds, interpreters do not agree concerning the meaning of these words. And indeed, of course, the scripture tells us essentially nothing about what the image of God is. It simply says that whatever it is, we have it. And so there's been a great deal of reflection on what this could mean, and it's quite diverse. Calvin goes on to say what he thinks it is. He says it's not the human body itself. It's not the human body itself, as admirable as the human body is. He thinks it. He thinks part of the idea of the image of God, part of it is our dominion. Our dominion as God's vicegerent in the government of the world, as God's subordinate governor in the government of the world. That's part of what it is, he thinks, the idea of dominion. An idea to which a number of modern theologians have come back and drawn on. Maybe not from Calvin, but from various sources have reflected on that. As for the fall, Calvin thinks that this has destroyed the image of God. Contrary to Italian Renaissance thinkers and many Roman Catholic thinkers who retain a notion of our created goodness in spite of the fall, Calvin, of course, thinks this is gone. But you need to restore it. You need to restore it through Christ to what it originally had been. It can be at least partly restored in this way. So this idea of a restoration of the fall will have its influence in natural philosophy as well, and I will get to that in a minute. But Calvin states this concept so that we can be restored to the image of God through regeneration. But even this is not the whole of God's image, is what he says. Even this. He's the seat of this as being the mind and the heart. So this is the seat of the image of God. But now, he says, although some obscure lineaments of that image are found remaining in us, so, well, he maybe qualifies slightly then what he says here, but some obscure lineaments of that are found remaining in us, yet are so vitiated and maimed that they may truly be said to be destroyed. So we just, the fall for him is devastating. It has obliterated the image of God. Just obscure lineaments left. So how do we get back to what we had before? He continues, so God created man in his own image. And Calvin says, the reiterated mention of the image of God is not a vain repetition. It's a remarkable instance of the divine goodness which can never be sufficiently proclaimed. And at the same time, he admonishes us from what excellence we have fallen. That is, God admonishes us from what excellence we have fallen, that he may excite in us the desire of its recovery. So, through regeneration, we can recover to significant extent the image of God. And I'll skip over that text. Now, let's consider yet another early modern text from the English philosopher and essayist Francis Bacon, whose image of this becomes very influential on English natural philosophy in the 17th century. Bacon argues that through natural philosophy, through what we today call science, we might even have, he says, a restitution and reinvesting of man to the sovereignty and power which he had in his first state of creation. So natural philosophy, science for Calvin, becomes a means through which we can be partly restored to the image of God. For Bacon, I'm sorry, right? Thank you. For Bacon, becomes a means through which. This is not a... So he's looking here not to a spiritual regeneration, but to the use of knowledge. He later says in another text that it is knowledge by which man fell, and knowledge through which he can be restored, see. So it's this idea. To speak plainly and clearly, he says, it is a discovery of all operations and possibilities of operations from immortality to the meanest mechanical practice. We want to restore ourselves to eternal life, you know, but also it affects to the meanest mechanical practice. He means really kind of like the trades and laboratories. That's what he means by that. Now, in the Scientific Revolution, another influential thinker, not on the issue of the fall, but on the issue of the soul in the image of God, is René Descartes. Now his views are still, I think, not always adequately understood. He's very typically seen as a classical dualist, whereas there's some recent argument that he might best be understood as more of a tritheist, if you will. That is, he has three entities, where humanity is a unique kind of entity, a new kind of combination of body and soul. But here's this famous text, for example. He does say, consistent with substance dualism, he says the rational soul cannot in any way be derived from the potentiality of matter, but it must have been expressly created. He says it is not enough that it be located in the human body like a pilot in a ship. It is not enough, except perhaps to move it, he says, but it must also be joined and united more closely with the body in order to have beyond that sensations and appetites, what they would have called passions at the time, similar to ours, and thus to compose a true man. Indeed, if you really want to understand Descartes' views on the soul, I think you need to read his text, The Passions, much more than Meditations or Discourse on Method, but The Passions. There's a unity of body and soul within the human, a unique kind of unity you don't find anywhere else. Now, of course, it's famously the case that he locates the join between body and soul in this pineal gland, is what he talks about. But people often gloss over the fact that it's a unity of body and soul in the human. There's an interactive unity of body and soul for Descartes. It's not this picture you often see of a simple bifurcated soul and body for the human. He goes on to say, this ego, that is the soul by which I am what I am, is entirely distinct from the body. And that's the kind of text that gives people the rise to say the other side, the dualist side, which he gives great emphasis to in texts like this. And even if the body did not exist, the soul would not cease to be what it is. So the soul is eternal, and it isn't material. But in the human, at least, it is intimately united with the body. Intimately united with the body. There is kind of an interaction of the body and the soul for Descartes. But the soul, indeed, is immortal by its very nature. And this concept, this Greekish sort of concept, will tie in with biblical conceptions in discussing the issue of evolution. Now, let me move past this and get to this. I want to jump now into the 19th century and talk about what happens then. The bottom line thing that happens then is that people begin to realize that the Earth is really very, very old and that creatures have been around a long time before we arrived on the scene. And that presents a number of challenges. But to jump into the challenges posed by evolution, I want to go to a pre-Darwinian text that's influential on both sides of the Atlantic. It's printed in Great Britain in 1844, and then the following year in the United States. And it's translated into many, many languages in the course of the 19th century and remains in print up until the end of the 19th century. It was a text that was published without the author's name on the title page, but the author was the publisher himself. It was Robert Chambers, a Scot. And here is what Chambers wrote. He was inspired by Lamarck, the French evolutionist, but he was also inspired by the nebular hypothesis of Laplace. And he argued for the continuous development of the solar system, but also living things, a continuity of living things. At the time, this text was seen as unpersuasive by both theologians and scientists alike, but it was wildly popular with the general public, particularly, as far as we can tell, among women in Victorian England. This was the first generation in which there was available a significant number of literate women, many of whom subscribed to some of Chambers' magazines, and they wanted to be informed about these kinds of issues, and they read this text. Disraeli's wife read it even, and Disraeli thought, indeed, that the book had to have been written by a woman. But anyway, the idea that any of the lower animals, he says, had been concerned in any way with the origin of man, okay, this continuity of humans and animals, he says, is this not degrading? Is it not degrading? Well, he draws an interesting analogy here. Here's what he says. He says, it's no more degrading to think that way than it is to think of the circumstances attending the production of an individual of our race. Okay? The analogy between human development in the individual and development in the species. Okay? If there's continuity in the individual, then if we have an animal origin, if you will, in our individual, then we may have an animal origin in the species itself. And he says, now the idea of progress of organic creation, if we become satisfied of its truth, ought to be received precisely in this spirit. If it has pleased providence to arrange that one species should give birth to another until the second highest gave birth to man, who's the very highest, be it so. It is our part to admire and to submit. So this is the way he presents this idea. And he then says, these creatures, the lower animals, are all of them products of the almighty conception, as well as ourselves. All of them display wondrous evidences of his wisdom and benevolence. This is an intelligent design version of theistic evolution, is what this is, if you want to put it in modern terms. But really not a very good one scientifically. How did Christian thinkers respond to Chambers? People often think of how they respond to Charles Darwin, but how did they respond to Chambers? Chambers' vision of a goal-directed evolutionary process culminating in humans. So this takes the design issue off the table, see. So this is a designed evolution thing. Just look at the issue without that in there. If evolution is designed, but there's continuity between humans and animals, what bothered people about that? Well, here's what Adam Sedgwick wrote. Adam Sedgwick was the person who taught geology at Cambridge, from whom Darwin had studies in the field in geology. Here's what he wrote. If the book be true, the labors of sober induction are in vain. In other words, this is just sheer speculation, basically. Religion is a lie. Human law is a mass of folly and a base injustice. Morality is moonshine. Our labors for the black people of Africa were works of madmen, and man and woman are only better beasts. You know, this is not acceptable either, this continuity of humans and animals. It's not the design issue, it's the continuity of humans and animals that's not acceptable. Or take the Scottish stonemason Hugh Miller, who was also a very active writer in the Scottish Free Kirk tradition. He wrote probably 10,000 words a week as the editor of publications, of magazines and newspapers and things for this tradition. And he wrote very widely books for the general public that were very popular at the time. He took an old earth approach at a time when that was still somewhat controversial. And he's a person early on who argues for a kind of metaphorical day approach to the Genesis text. So that places him. But continuity between humans and the animals was simply not acceptable to Miller. He rejects Chambers, first on geological grounds. That is, he sees discontinuities in the fossil record. And he even goes on to say about that, that he says, there's no progression. What he really doesn't mean is progress of animal forms. He means continuity of animal forms. If fish rose into reptiles, it must have been by sudden transmutation. There's no getting rid of miracle in the case. There's no alternative between creation and metamorphosis, that is, transmutation, whether or not it's guided. The infidel substitutes progression for deity. Geology robs him of his God, he says. Geology decisively shows you can't get continuity between various kinds of animals, including humans and animals. This is his view in responding to Chambers in the 1840s. Now here, for Miller, I think this is the bottom line for Miller, the bottom line objection. So this lengthy passage is really important to understand. And I've highlighted the two key words here in red. If, during a period so vast as to be scarce expressible by figures, the creatures now human have been rising by almost infinitesimals from compound microscopic cells until they have at length become the men and women we see around us. Okay, if there's a real continuity, if molecules to man is true, in other words, he says, we must either hold the monstrous belief that all the vitalities, whether those of monads or of mites, of fishes or reptiles, or birds or beasts, are individually and inherently immortal and undying, or that human souls are not so. In other words, either everything is immortal or nothing is. That's what he says. The difference between the dying and the undying, between the spirit of the brute that goes up and the spirit of the man that goes the spirit of the brute that goes down, the spirit of the man that goes up, is not a difference infinitesimally or even atomically small. It possesses all the breadth of eternity to come and is an infinitely great distance. So this continuity question related to the conception of immortality in the soul, the image of God, this is what caused Miller and many others in his day to reject a design version of evolution, a design version, a clear design version. Or in America, if we consider one of the leading Hebrew scholars of the time, Taylor Lewis of Union College, here's what he says about Chambers. This sounds like Hodge talking about Darwin, doesn't it? The doctrine of the book is atheism. This is the design evolution, it's a design scheme. But the doctrine of the book is atheism. Blank atheism. Cold, cheerless, heartless atheism. So it's this continuity issue. Again, it's not the design question. Chambers' God, Lewis points out, hears no prayers, administrates no particular providence, has no love for what is right and no hatred for what is wrong, and exercises no moral government. He senses Chambers as kind of a deist, and basically I think Chambers is. This deity never wrought a miracle, never created a world in time by any special act aside from necessarily eternal influences, never was the author of any new state of things or ever brought a special end to a special end any old dispensation. Well, if we look at the leading American geologist of the time, the first American to write a textbook on geology, Edward Hitchcock of Amherst College in Massachusetts, in responding not to Chambers, but to Charles Lyell, whose work he liked, here is what Hitchcock wrote. The production of new forms of animal and vegetable life must be regarded, as it ever has been, as the highest and most astonishing exercise of creative power. And if that power can be supposed to reside in the laws of nature, it seems to us that there is no phenomenon in the universe that will require a higher power. And we are reduced at once to materialism and atheism. So again, this is not the design issue. This is the issue of just whether there's continuity between humans and animals and whether there's miracles in the creation. There's no evidence, he says, that the vital principle is ever communicated by any other power than that of Almighty God. So let me reflect on those comments which had nothing to do with Darwin, all of which were pre-Darwinian, by looking at what happens throughout the century as a whole. Historian John Roberts, who in my view has written the best book about the history of this controversy in America, about the later Darwin controversy, commented this. For most of the 19th century, he notes, it was the consensus among apologists that the doctrine of special creation was central to the defense of the Christian worldview. And this ensured that the Darwinian hypothesis would be widely perceived as a challenge to the structure of natural theology. So, you know, he's looking back to the whole of the 19th century, and then when he looks more narrowly at what happens with Darwinism in America, the background to this conversation helps explain why Darwinism is seen as such a serious threat. It's not the design issue per se, as it would be for Hodge. The design issue is part of it, but a core issue for them is the doctrine of special creation. So there we have that. Now let's jump ahead to the question of whether evolution in a Darwinian sense, or in a broader sense, is atheistic. I won't take time to go into the details of this really interesting image. You can ask me about it afterward if you want, but this is an image that William Jennings Bryan designed, and it was drawn by a famous cartoonist at the time. It's concerning what evolution is going to do, what evolution is going to do to you. It's going to cause you as a Christian to doubt the infallibility of the Bible, and then from there you're going to doubt that man's made in God's image, and then you're going to doubt miracles, the virgin birth, no atonement, no resurrection, and you're going to end up in atheism. Now, there's a lot more in this cartoon than I just explained, but that's the essence of what I wanted to get at from the cartoon for my purposes here now. So I want to go into this issue of what does evolution mean for us? What does evolution mean for us? Does it mean atheism? Well, we've seen it did for people in Chambers' day. Just the idea of continuity meant atheism. But when Darwin comes on the scene and raises questions about design, is that also another example, another cause of concern? Well, the first evolutionist in America, the first Darwinian, I should say, in America, was Asa Gray, the Harvard botanist whom Bethany told us a lot of interesting stuff about on Saturday. But here I want to consider a text that I don't think she considered. She was looking at correspondence with Darwin. His lectures that he gave at Yale College in 1880, Natural Science and Religion. This is a fascinating text. It's not usually looked at. And here in this text, Gray, giving two lectures to the divinity students at Yale, says he defends what he calls the compatibility of evolution and traditional theism. And as for his theism, the nature of his Christian theism, he says, is briefly summed up in the Apostles and Nicene Creeds. I mean, he was an Orthodox Christian. In his view, evolution presented no new challenges to theism, no new perplexities, he says, to theism, but it did soften the impact of natural theology. He granted that now people might have an out. You know, Dawkins' famous comment about Darwin making it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. Gray sees that coming, and he talks about that in this text back in 1880. He doesn't think that's correct. He says if you look at the whole of the history of things, it looks like it was intended. He takes a longer view. He goes on to say, then, that I accept Christianity on its own evidence, and I'm yet to learn how physical or any other science conflicts with it any more than it conflicts with simple theism. I take it that religion is based on the idea of a divine mind revealing himself to intelligent creatures for moral ends, an incarnational theology. And he takes that very seriously. And this is one of the reasons why he does not find inherent difficulty with evolution. A similar approach, I would suggest, in terms of being affirmation of modern science and the truth of the historic creeds today, would be here. Okay, Polkinghorne's book, The Faith of a Physicist, is indeed a commentary on the Nicene Creed. Now, he's written many, many other texts, but I see in overall attitudes, I see Polkinghorne as very similar to Asa Gray. I don't find people like Polkinghorne out there on the landscape in the 1920s when Asa Gray is long dead, but I do think it comes to a hiatus. But I think there's actually a number of writers today like Polkinghorne. He's not alone in taking this kind of an attitude today. But one could also argue at the time that evolution is atheism, Darwinian evolution specifically, and that's what Charles Hodge does in his famous book, What is Darwinism? He argues that it is atheism, and it's atheism because it denies design. So he takes a different angle on it. It's not so much its special creation issue, although he talks about that. He says what makes it atheistic is the denial of design. Gray found a way to insert design into it. Hodge didn't see where you could do that with Darwinian evolution, and he therefore thought it was atheism. I'm going to skip through these quotations to just go to this one. He says, we have thus arrived at our answer. What is Darwinism? It is atheism, he says. He says it is atheism. And that's the same kind of approach, I think, that one finds here in the writing of Philip Johnson. In Johnson's view, modern theistic evolutionists don't get it. They don't get that Darwinian evolution is inherently atheistic. And so if you say you're a theistic evolutionist who accepts Darwinian evolution, you're either muddle-headed or you're caving into heterodoxy because of your worries about your career or something like this. But that's what his perspective, that he's saying, look, you need to realize that Darwinian evolution is what Coyne and Dawkins say that it is. It's atheism. And you can't accept it if you're going to be consistently a Christian. Yet a third kind of approach to these issues, other than Gray's acceptance of a consistency between Orthodox Christianity and evolution, or Hodge's rejection of it, is transforming Christianity into something almost unrecognizably different, I would suggest, in the work of some of the modernists in the early 20th century. An example would be Shaler Matthews, the dean of the Divinity School at Chicago, the title of whose autobiography tells you where he's coming from. He wants a new faith for the old. And Matthews, not dealing so much with evolution, but dealing with the coming to America of laboratory science, which wasn't taught in most American colleges and universities in the 19th century until very late. But the teaching methods of science, which are laboratory-based, he says, that method of instruction did something more than lead to research. It undermined habits of thought and substituted the tentativeness of experiment for authoritative formulas. Well, authoritative formulas, you can plug in the Apostles and Nicene Creeds as two examples if you want to, okay? He says, true, there were some scientists like Asa Gray who championed Darwinian evolution while holding to the Nicene Creed. But Matthew says, his fellow churchmen really didn't like that, basically, is what Matthew says. And he sees that as an approach he doesn't take either. Matthew thinks that approach is not helpful. Matthew thinks you need to do more than this. As he says, prior to the introduction of these methods, scientific method had not touched religious thought. It was only when educational processes had ceased to be controlled by the study of classical literature and grew to be contemporary that orthodox theology was felt to be incompatible with intellectual integrity. Now, that's quite a statement. Okay? Very different attitude toward these issues. And basically, I would argue that Matthews was one of the more radical of the modernist theologians, not quite as radical as some of his contemporaries, but one of the more radical modernist theologians that essentially all but stripped God of transcendence. It's not clear even that Matthews even believed in God late in his life, although he believed in immortality. Robert Millikan tells a story in Millikan's autobiography where he says that Matthews once was asked whether he believed in God, and Matthews said, that, sir, requires an education rather than an answer. Okay? Someone asked me that, I have a one-word answer, and it starts with a Y. Now, I think an example of this today might be someone like David Griffin at Claremont with his religion and scientific naturalism, a naturalistic theology. Well, at this point now, I'm at the end of the scheduled 45 minutes, but we started about 10 minutes late. I'm not going to take all of the 10 minutes because I'm going to leave a little bit of time for questions. So what I would like to do, though, is to point out the difference between even the most radical modernists and materialism. And what distinguishes him from the real materialist is this. Matthews and the other modernists believe in human freedom. They believe in human freedom. And in a very interesting correspondence he has with an atheistic banker in Chicago in 1923, Matthews says this. As long as there are personalities resulting from evolution, there must be that within the process itself which is capable of producing it. It is quite impossible for any man to think that personality comes out from impersonality. The thoroughgoing mechanistic interpretation of evolution and nature itself simply denies the presence of anything approaching free will. You know, this, he's reflecting here, I think, personalism. A philosophy that's popular in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, that he has vestiges of that in his philosophy. But it's compatible, of course, with traditional theism. But this is about the only thing he's got in this point that's compatible with traditional theism, except his belief in immortality, which is not grounded in a belief in the resurrection. It's grounded in a belief in the goodness of God. And indeed, there are materialists who think this is the case, that there's no free will. And a famous example of this today would be Will Provine. Many of you know that Provine has made statements to this effect. To go to the second one is the bottom line here. Human beings are marvelously complex machines, and heredity and environment is all there is. And there's no way the evolutionary process can produce a being that's truly free to make choices. Complete opposite conclusion of someone like Ken Miller, who thinks that you have to use a Darwinian process to get free will. Provine thinks there's no way to get free will from evolution. Well, I could go on and talk about social Darwinism and things. I have a number of slides on that, but I'm out of time if I'm going to leave any time for questions. So I think this is a good place just to end it, and I will do that. So thanks for your attention. I'll leave the slides up here in case there's a question about something and I need to go back to one. So we have maybe 7 minutes at the most for questions if you would like to ask any. Yes? Please speak up a little. I don't hear too well up here. In part, partly related, yeah. Then how does he
square
that with
the idea that that's been destroyed by the fall? Do
we
lose dominion through the fall, or
do you
say that?
That's a great question. People here that know Calvin better than I do, but my sense is that we didn't lose that. We didn't lose dominion. Is that correct?
Well, we exercise it badly.
Yeah, it's not as big a loss as there was to the image of God itself, to the rest of the image of God, to our relationship with God and our likeness to God in our character. That's my sense, but I'd be very happy to have someone correct me if they think that I've misreading Calvin on this at all.
I think you really hit on one of the big issues of evolution and its acceptance. I remember when Francis Collins gave his talk, and Jim Peterson asked the most provocative questions. Why would God use such a random event with so much death and suffering and everything else to create, you know? And Francis essentially, you know, said he didn't know. But I think that you know, when people try to construct, and as I've studied ethics last year, try to construct an ethic based on evolution, they end up with, you know, as you didn't get into social Darwinism, but
right. That's
sort of what people end up with. And then they, you know, with the eugenics movement in this country, that scares people. And how do you get out of evolution, what God is trying to teach us through evolutionary processes, or do we just say there's nothing we can learn from? And that kind of goes against all kinds of natural law thinking. So how do you
Well, ultimately, I think the theodicy question, which is what the bigger question I hear you asking about, I think the theodicy question has no really satisfactory answer as a formal philosophical and theological response. I mean, there's a number of options that are less than satisfactory. I put the question sometimes in this form: why did God not make heaven now? Okay? Because if we take seriously the idea of a new heaven and earth, well, we know that God could have made a world in which these things are not present. And he didn't. And we don't know why that is the case. And of course, if one takes takes seriously the age of the earth issue that I was opening up that one section with, the long, deep history of time issue, then it's very difficult to retain a notion of the fall of humanity being responsible for a world of that nature. Now, very difficult. Now, Bill Densky is going to explain later this morning, using Edward Hitchcock, whom I presented you with here earlier, taking right out of Edward Hitchcock an idea from the 1840s, how you might be able to keep the link between human sin and animal death as long as it's not a chronological link. He'll use superlapsarianism to do that. But that's what Hitchcock did. It's an unusual approach, but it was already there in the 19th century. But it's difficult to see how you can do that. It's difficult to see how you can do that. I like myself, Professor Schneider yesterday, I believe the most profound theological text in the Bible is Job. And I think that the reading of the book of Job leaves us in puzzlement about this issue. And I don't think there's going to be theologically and philosophically a fully satisfactory answer on this side of that other world. Existentially, I would approach it in terms of creation bearing the image of the second person of the Trinity who suffered unto death, not that we might not suffer, as George MacDonald says, but that our suffering might be like his. That's what George MacDonald said in the 19th century, and C.S. Lewis has that as the epigram to the problem of pain. The Son of God suffered unto death, not that men might not suffer, but that their suffering might be like his. It's a very, very different way of viewing it. It's an incarnational theology of creation. And if we've done nothing, if in the Christian tradition, at least in the Protestant Christian tradition until recently, there hasn't really been much reflection on creation from an incarnational point of view. It's been much, except insofar as there's the logos, the more rational aspect of this that's been considered, but not the other side, not the creation and resurrection of Jesus, and how that may relate to creation itself. That'll have to be the last question. Thanks.